This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Colonisation and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded, and this always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian news and politics with a side of crispy memes. We are also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group. I am a mod on the group. My name is Zach LeSnack, and with me as always is confidant and member of my inner sanctum.
Hi, I'm Noon, also known as I Know Funkenstein. You've used that confidant and inner sanctum line a couple times since we did that story about that... Australian referring to Scott Morrison's wife as his inner sanctum.
Yeah. Confidant, yeah.
But it's nice to be, you know, on the same level as Scott Morrison's wife is to him with you. So, you know, thanks, Zach. It's nice to be here. And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again.
You are one of my main advisors. So, yes, thank you for joining us. We are departing from our usual formula a little bit this week. We're just going to do one big mains story about cultural burning. So this is to obviously coincide with Invasion Day. And we wanted to talk about cultural burning specifically and First Nations fire management and land management practices in general, because there's been a lot of conversation about it in the news in the wake of the bushfires and conversation about appropriating or using cultural burning to stop these horrible bushfires or make them... less bad. We have a few things and thoughts about that. But we have found that a lot of the conversation about this stuff has been relatively superficial in the mainstream media and sometimes downright tokenistic and appropriative, especially when it's being deployed by conservative politicians. And we think it's important as settlers to try and engage and learn about this stuff as much as we can in an actual meaningful way and understand what something like cultural burning actually means to First Nations people and how it's connected to culture and identity, as opposed to just seeing it as another in an arsenal of fire management techniques that we as a settler colony might be able to deploy to defend ourselves.
I think it's important, Zach, for us and our listeners to remember that, like, the horror bushfires that we're experiencing are directly as a result of colonization. And we'll kind of go into this a bit more towards the sort of second half of the episode, but the way in which, like, European colonizers have completely changed the landscape of the continent means... like, it's just something to reflect on, that although we're being subject to fires, that's largely as a result of our own actions and our own way of treating First Nations people and their land.
Absolutely. I think that really complicates the discussion around cultural burning because there's been a lot of discussion about, okay, well, maybe now we will empower First Nations people to practice this traditional form of land management in order to defend our, like, settler
colonial cities
and farms, etc., without sort of an acknowledgement of the fact that we have stopped First Nations people from practicing this stuff by dispossessing them and committing genocide. So there's a lot to kind of discuss here. We're probably going to get a fair amount wrong and leave a lot of stuff out. So if you have anything that you would like to correct us on or contribute to the discussion in any way, please come and find us in the Facebook group or on our Facebook page. Or if you really care, then record a little bit of audio of yourself and send it into the show. Email us at auspolsnackpod@gmail.com and we'll play it on the show.
And just to be clear, we're not going to be doing other news stories this week. We're just talking about cultural burning.
That's the big mains this week. So I guess we'll kick it off by just covering briefly, like, what the discussion around managing bushfires in the future has been over the past week. So what we've seen is Scott Morrison starting to talk about focusing on hazard reduction, burning, as opposed to taking action on climate change. Fucking hell. So obviously this is a misdirection, you know, deliberate misdirection to stop people talking about the broader causes for a much worse and longer bushfire season, which we know and have known for a long time is climate change. And obviously the actions of this and many previous governments, you know, we can directly attribute climate damage to them. So Scott Morrison is kind of trying to direct conversation away from that by saying that hazard reduction burns are more important than taking climate action in order to stop future bushfires. So there's a couple of issues with this. And one thing I just wanted to quickly talk about up top as well is the distinction between hazard reduction burns or fuel reduction burns, as they're also known. Those are the same thing. And backburning, on the other hand. So which I think people kind of there's been conversation where people have been using those terms interchangeably.
Yeah.
So the difference between hazard reduction burns and backburning is that backburning is used during a fire, basically, to try and provide a buffer or a line of defense against a currently burning bushfire. That's often, you know, carried out by, and those are carried out by firefighters. Whereas a hazard reduction burn is, or a prescribed burn is something that happens in advance and is scheduled.
In the cool season, usually during winter.
Exactly. And often that is aimed at, or this is why they're called, also called fuel reduction burns, is to burn off plant matter that is on the ground that could make fires worse.
Yep.
So we're talking about, when Scott Morrison is talking about hazard reduction, he's talking about burning in advance. And when we're talking about cultural burning, that is, cultural burning is distinct again from hazard reduction burning, but backburning is an entirely separate thing, and we're not going to be talking about that this episode. So one of the first things that we kind of wanted to talk about just off top is what it actually means or how the experience of seeing this land on fire is different for First Nations people than it is for colonizers like ourselves. And one person that I thought summed this up beautifully was Tarneen Onus Williams, who's one of the organizers of Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance. And this is just a tweet from them. Budjbim was just UNESCO World Heritage listed and it is on fire. My Gondij Mara country is burning. So it's a very different experience watching land burn when it is part of your identity, part of your cultural heritage. And as we've previously discussed, we know that there is like actual measurable psychological and emotional and physical harm that comes to First Nations people when land is damaged like this.
Something that the Fire Sticks Alliance, who was a big source for this, the research that we did for this episode, and we'll talk a bit more about them later, but they talk a lot about how being involved in traditional land management is really, really good for the First Nations people, and that having a connection with country and learning the history and the song lines and the practices and the routines of the plants and animals under their care, it has really, really direct and positive results on the people who are participating in that. And I think watching the bushfires is exactly the same, but in reverse.
Yeah.
That the way that it hurts is so much more fundamental and
it's personal,
you know, and
you know, not just through the lens of like property damage, but actually what it means to have an actual connection to the country in and of itself, not just a patch of it that you have, you know, staked out of your own.
Around,
not to diminish the trauma and pain of people who've lost houses, of course. I mean, I think you make a really good point here, and this is one of the sort of main things we wanted to talk about, is the kind of conceptual distinction between, on the one hand, like hazard reduction burning in order to stop burning,
it's
conducted by the government.
A tactical process,
in order to stop bushfires happening, and the difference between that and cultural burning, which is actually one of just many ways to engage with the country and the land. That it's not just about burning or preventing bushfires, that it serves a whole number of other purposes, but it's first and foremost a cultural practice. So I just wanted to read from the Fire Sticks Alliance website. So Fire Sticks Alliance are an indigenous corporation who basically teach cultural burning to First Nations people who want to learn, and they spread and share that knowledge.
And they've actually got a podcast about cultural burning called Right Fire, Right Country, which you should check out and listen to if you're interested. It's a little mini series. Each episode's about 10, 15 minutes long.
Absolutely. So I just want to read their description of the term cultural burning. So they say, we use the term cultural burning to describe burning practices developed by Aboriginal people to enhance the health of the land and its people. Cultural burning can include burning or prevention of burning of country for the health of plants and animals. It may involve patch burning to create different fire intervals across the landscape, or could be used for fuel and hazard reduction. Fire may be used to better access to country, to gain better access to country, to clean up important pathways, maintain cultural responsibilities, and as a part of culture, heritage management. It is ceremony to welcome people to country, or it could also be as simple as a campfire around which people gather to share, learn, and celebrate.
So I think that's really illustrates the sort of broadness of this practice. And fire was basically the fundamental tool used by First Nations people to relate to the landscape prior to Western colonization. Obviously, there were lots of other practices, but I think that, yeah, that it can be used for all sorts of different things, including the hazard reduction, which we are kind of...
That's the element of it that's been pulled out, and exactly. I feel like people are conflating cultural burning with hazard reduction.
Absolutely.
But as fire sticks goes into there... That is just one. It's multifaceted, and to look at it from only that one prism, because right now
that's
convenient.
What benefits the white Australia.
Exactly. So that's why this conversation around this has been so problematic, and we wanted to kind of try and add a little bit of depth to that. And just to kind of further this, just to go into a bit more detail, I guess, about this, the idea of cultural burning as an integral part of like cultural relationship with the land. I just wanted to read a quote from an article from a writer named Sean Hooper, who's writing for Indigenous X, which if you don't know Indigenous X, get or not, they publish all sorts of amazing First Nations writing. So Sean Hooper is a Wiradjuri man and a fire behavior analyst and a volunteer firefighter, as well as a cultural burning practitioner. He says, cultural burning is firstly one of the ways Aboriginal people maintain their relationship with country. Non-Aboriginal people sometimes struggle with understanding the basis of how Aboriginal cultural fire practitioners implement an Aboriginal cultural burn. It does not generally look like hazard reduction. This is because it is not. An Aboriginal cultural burn is guided by the close relationship that the Aboriginal cultural fire practitioner has with country and everything in it. So I think what Sean Hooper is getting at here is that at the center of cultural burning is a continued connection and relationship with an understanding of the land.
Yep.
It's not something that you do for one specific purpose in preparation for bushfire or, for its other uses, for example, for creating grasslands or helping plants to germinate and that kind of thing.
There's a quote from a Western Australian researcher, which I got out of The Biggest Estate on Earth by Bill Gammage, which is about First Nations land management practices. This person says, what must be made absolutely clear is that the rules for fire and fire use are many and varied and are dependent upon intimate knowledge of the physical and spiritual nature of each portion of the land. Without this knowledge, it is impossible to care for country in the appropriate way. An Arnhem man explained, you sing the country before you burn it. And in your mind, you see the fire, you know where it's going, and you know where it'll stop. Only then do you light the fire. And I think that illustrates a similar kind of thing about that it's very different in different parts of country. There are different rules, there are different times, different places, different purposes. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So when people on the right, or even, probably well-meaning people on the left talk about, okay, one of the reasons why our bushfires are so bad is that we aren't doing or enabling First Nations people to conduct cultural burns anymore. We just need to get cultural burning happening again, and the bushfires won't be as bad next time. So there's a few kind of problems with that. And one of the ones that we've discussed, obviously, is that, the problematic nature of trying to deploy First Nations knowledge in order to defend settler colonial cities and farms and that kind of thing.
Lifestyles, yeah.
But, as we've talked about, cultural burning is part of, Indigenous identity. It can't be pulled out and deployed in isolation as a tool for preventing bushfires. It is tied up in actually having access to your land. Exactly. So there's a quote here I wanted to read from Taylor Watson, a Birrugaba and Kungalu Muri artist on Twitter. Her handle is at Ancestress Era. Highly recommend following her. And she says, one thing that worries me is when people approach our knowledges about climate change like it's not wrapped up in our sovereignty. Using our knowledges without giving our lands back is not a solution to the climate crisis or the social issues we have as humans in this continent. Which I think really, I mean, she's said it a lot better than I than I long-windedly have. But I think that the way that people are discussing trying to use cultural burning to protect the Australian country from bushfires is kind of a furthering in many ways of colonial violence and appropriation.
And I think it also illustrates the sort of like silly, self-serving, cynical nature in which Scott Morrison is trying to deploy this discussion. I mean, I'm not sure he's been talking about cultural burn specifically.
But definitely there has been a lot of chatter about it.
On the right wing in general, at least. Yeah, it just like reinforces that these people don't know what they're talking about and are trying to steal.
Well, it's like any justification that they can use to divert the conversation away from actual action on climate change.
Right, but also away from actual empowerment of First Nations people or like helping restore sovereignty or all of these other things. It's like, look, we'll tokenistically appropriate this piece of knowledge and then we'll pretend that that makes our relationship with First Nations fine.
Yeah, and I think that, you've kind of hit the nail on the head as well in terms of what people on the left are accidentally reinforcing when they talk about wanting to employ cultural burning. Because if you're not talking about sovereignty and land rights and giving land back, then you're just appropriating First Nations knowledge for your own purposes. And that's just colonization all over again.
Yeah. And to be clear, this is not to be negative about people who are using cultural burning techniques as part of the effort to prevent the bushfires at the moment. Obviously, those people should be doing what they feel is right for their country, and it's great that they're helping to deploy those knowledges. This is absolutely about how white Western settlers are trying to relate to this and doing a terrible job of it in various different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that Taylor Watson talked about there is, talking about knowledges around climate change. And one thing that I think it's important to consider as well when we're talking about, trying to not reintroduce, because a lot of cultural burning has always happened. It's just that we have massively restricted it with colonization, and we've actually even made it illegal.
Criminalizing and arresting and attacking and murdering people who are trying to do it. Especially in very early days, but also ever since then.
For sure. People being shut out of their own land if they are found to be culturally burning, charged with arson and that kind of thing. So we have massively reduced it, but we haven't stopped it. So it's not reintroducing this stuff, but it's about expanding it and trying to
empower the practitioners.
Exactly. But one of the sort of complicating elements of this is that it's a very different climate and landscape that we exist in now than before colonization. So you talked before about the way that colonization changed the landscape physically, and you'll get a bit more into that. I know you've got a few things, especially from the greatest estate on earth that you wanted to get into, which is really interesting, and we'll get into that. But I just wanted to touch on the fact that also, obviously, climate change has created a radically different environment. And I think to believe now that suddenly we can implement traditional knowledge that was developed over tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years during pre-colonial times can get us out of this colonial problem is pretty short-sighted, and this almost like weirdly like kicking the can down the road of being like, okay, we've fucked up the country and now it's your responsibility, First Nations people, to fix it for us. I think that lacks nuance. And even in general, when people like Scott Morrison are talking about wanting to do more hazard reduction burns, as if that's a replacement for climate action.
Yep.
If you want to give yourself more time to effectively do fuel reduction burning, you need a bigger window.
Yeah.
And how are you going to get that? Obviously, climate action. Like, what the fuck are you doing? But so let's get into... now, you know, we've talked a bit about how the conversation around this practice is happening and what our problems are with it. But Noon, you wanted to get into a little bit more detail on what the actual, like, physical results of cultural burning have been on the yeah. Australian landscape. Well, I say Australia doesn't exist, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, so first up, I just want to say the main source that I used for this was The Biggest Estate on Earth by Bill Gammage. It's a real good book. It's got a lot of really excellent information about it, not only about burning, but all sorts of other land management practices. And I thought there was a really good chapter on the dreaming and song lines, which explained those things in ways that I found very accessible as a white person with only very sort of limited and stereotyped knowledge about that stuff. So it's a really valuable book with a lot of good information, but I was mainly trying to get stuff out of it about cultural burning. And there was this one sentence from it that just really stuck with me, which is, there was no wilderness. In 1788, there was no wilderness on the continent that we now call Australia. Every single inch of the land was being actively monitored, cared for, and cultivated, and stewarded, I guess that's the word, by the First Nations people. It's kind of funny in a really depressing genocide kind of way, but a lot of the information in The Biggest Estate comes from, like, diaries of early British settlers.
Very similar to Dark Emu, yep. But you have to, if you're reading those sources, you have to obviously read between the lines or yeah. read between the races, and more specifically.
And there's so much stuff like, wow, this looks exactly like a cultivated park that I own back in Britain that I have, like, a bunch of people maintaining all the time.
What a coincidence.
I guess it must be just how it was. These people
obviously
could have nothing to do with
God
that.
God wants me to put sheep here. That is what's going on.
And a lot of the book is about trying to illustrate the way in which that the land as found by white people, or encountered, I should say, by white people in 1788, could not have been natural. Mm. And the main tool that were used by First Nations people to maintain those different landscapes was fire. And so there is some really fascinating stuff where there would be, you know, a row of trees that any kind of fire, a forest that any fire would have just completely destroyed them. And then, like, 5 meters away, there are yams growing that need fires every 2 years to survive. And these different landscapes were maintained with fire. So, there's a little quote here. Five features marked fire in 1788. It was planned, it was precise, it could be repeated and hence predicted, it was organized locally, and it was universal. Like the songlines, it united the continent. And this idea of organized local but for a universal goal is also really important. The traditional burning created a mosaic. So little patches of different types of land all over the place, which would have different purposes. Some would be for food crops, some for fiber crops. Some would have certain types of animals, others would have different types of animals. And so here's a quote. The effect of traditional burning regimes was to produce a series of small patches of country at different stages of recovery from fire with associated different plant and animal communities. This system of burning with minor adjustments in relation to the particular type of country and the time of year produces a mosaic of plant communities in different stages of fire recovery. Once this mosaic has been initiated, it would be relatively easy to maintain and could be used to protect certain areas from fire for a considerable time. I think that's important to know that, like, the forests were being maintained by fire, the plains were being maintained by fire, the rainforests were being maintained by fire, and also that they had been shaped by them historically. So there's this one example, I think this is mostly in, like, the Tarkine and other parts of Tasmania, but there are these rainforests with no eucalypts growing in them, right? And that no eucalypts can grow there because of the way that the canopy is shaped and because of lack of fire and so on. But towering over the canopy, like three times taller than all the other trees, are these ancient eucalypts. And there's no way that could have been done naturally. There's some really fucked things, like colonizers would be, you know, quote unquote, exploring, walking through country and find like a row of 80 trees that were growing in two perfect straight lines as like a ceremonial space that people would walk down, and they'd be like, huh, isn't that weird that these trees just completely naturally grew in this like artistic arrangement?
I mean, I think it speaks to, it's not just that you come in with a mindset of white supremacy and everything kind of just falls into place around that. You have to just be actively, deliberately seeing things and willfully ignoring
what they
human
must
intervention.
Mean. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. It's like reading, and it's a similar experience reading Dark Emu in the sense of just like, it's this kind of coexisting feelings of like amazement at all of the amazing and really cool practices that were being deployed, and just
the horror.
So, yeah, so depressing reading of these colonial accounts where they just completely discount the possibility that First Nations people could have in any way been managing the land. It's just like, how do you hold that, those two things in your head? It's fucked.
Yeah. We sort of started off this section talking about the way that colonization has made bushfires worse, and you were talking about climate, and I think that is a really important one. But it's also the way that we've destroyed these landscapes that were previously being maintained carefully. And Gamage gives examples of, for example, a place where a dairy farm was set up in early colonial era that was open pasture, which is why they set up a dairy farmland there when they arrived.
Yeah, conveniently open pasture.
Exactly. And then the dairy farm shut down, and 40 years later, that landscape is now heavily wooded forest, which isn't how it was prior to colonization. And it just goes to show that like there are all of these landscapes that we now as white Australians might think of as bush that didn't even remotely exist prior to 1788. Like the like dense scrub that's hard to walk through didn't exist because it was all being carefully maintained for the appropriate use and the appropriate ceremonies and the appropriate animal and plant relationships. So anyway, I just kind of want to touch on that, that as well as the sort of global colonialism of climate change, there's also specific local, like right on this spot colonialism that's changed landscapes in ways that have destroyed or at least erased or hidden First Nations practices and sovereignty and relationships.
Yeah. I think your example of like, you know, of a dairy farm, you know, being propped up and then dismantled and then bush kind of taking its place is a great illustration of one of the results of like a colonial, bringing a colonial mindset to a land that was managed without one.
Yeah.
You know, and with the with what you might like call the opposite of a colonial mindset, which as you say was kind of collective, not just within these individual nations and clans, but also there was consistent land management across the entire continent.
Yeah.
But then you have people coming in who have this concept of private property and a piece of land for me and a piece of land for, you know, you, and these are all separate and fenced off, and I just take care of my part of it.
Yeah.
And I don't have to engage or understand or know anything about any of the country elsewhere. All I need to do is maintain my little patch of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think you can trace a very direct line from this sort of this cap, not only colonialist but capitalist mindset that has come into this country, divided it up and made it vulnerable to natural disaster.
I like, obviously we don't have either the knowledge or time to really get into the dreaming and song lines in great detail, but I think it's really important as we're trying to do our best to see the complexity and interrelatedness of all of these different practices. I just wanted to read again, another quote from Biggest Estate about the dreaming and songline. So, a songline is also a map, compass, and calendar. It follows paths ecologically suited to its creator ancestor and teaches how to exploit resources en route. If you can sing a song, you can follow it, even into country you've never been. If you can't, unless someone with you knows it, you're lost. If you stray too far off the line, you might be trespassing. Songlines also recite country's ecological signals to people and animals. When coral trees flower, it's time to dig crabs. When a bird sings, a grub lays eggs. When the west wind blows, blue-tongued lizards emerge, and women dig for honey ants. When marsh flies appear, crocodiles lay eggs. And when the blackwoods flower, northwest Tasmanians hunted mutton birds. And so I think that's, although none of that's about burning, it shows the way in which these practices are deeply connected to the land, and the timing of the practices is connected to the land, and the way that we've destroyed the land has also interfered with these songlines. And not to mention the way that we've killed and traumatized and dispossessed the people who held that knowledge.
You've got a couple of like parallel vicious cycles there, that basically managing the land was based on understanding patterns and listening to the land, and when that was disrupted, then suddenly those things aren't there to read. So, which, you know, makes it harder all over again to actually listen and give the land what it needs. And then, as you say, the concurrent like destruction of the actual knowledge itself.
So that's sort of a bit more, I guess, context and conceptual stuff about the context in which these cultural burns were taking place. But something that I found really irritating when trying to do research about this, especially in kind of a news context, is there was absolutely no detail whatsoever about the practice. And that's not my knowledge, and I don't know anything about fires really anyway, and it wouldn't be my place to share it if I did. But there is some technical stuff that I think is not secret knowledge, and that it's appropriate for us to talk about, and that's about cool burning. So it's a bit hard to think about as white people, but there were lots of different types of fires that were used in this land. So most of the fires that were used were cool fires, some were medium and some were hot, and they were used for different purposes, and in different countries, you know, in different parts of this continent, hot burns were used for one thing and cool for another, and that other parts they were sort of reversed. And so just one example of that is that if there's like a eucalypt forest that needed to be converted to grassland, repeated cool and frequent fires were used in dry country, and hot and infrequent ones are used in wet fires, right? And so to convert to grass, they had to get quite a hot fire. But if you wanted to convert it into woodland, then you only burn every 2 or 4 years instead of every year, and that sort of thing. So the specifics about the type of fire that we used, when it was used, and where it was used, were also intimately connected with the outcomes that they were trying to achieve, right? So that if this forest needed to be a clearing for a cultural meeting site, then they would use one type of fire. If it was grassland that they wanted to turn into forest, then they would use a different type of fire.
I mean, the other thing that you sort of touched on there is that these are like very site-specific practices and knowledges, and that's one of the other problems with treating the concept of cultural burning as like a monolithic thing that is known
and
by First Nations people.
And thinking of it as tactical as well.
Of course. But so you've got, obviously, like coastal nations are going to have knowledges of very different forms of vegetation and landscape and how to manage those with fire compared to, say, inland nations who are going to have, you know, exist in a very different landscape, and so are going to have developed different fire, like cultural burning practices, which is not to say that nations and clans didn't share, and that's those knowledges, and that's part of what the songlines, part of the discussion about songlines and how that comes into it as well.
But something that I was trying to drill down into some of the technical details here, and the issue about how fires were cool versus hot sort of was a bit difficult for me to get my head around. And I think there were a few different things, and it was mostly about careful planning, basically. And this is something that we see done much more crudely by Western colonial fire services about, like, we're going to do it at this time of day when we know that there's no wind and that there's rain predicted and that sort of thing. So here's another quote. Fire managers burn precisely. They did not light in the wrong conditions or with the wrong fuel. They pick the grass up and they scrunch it in their hand. And if it gets too powdery, well, it's no more lighting grass. You burn in the bulur time, the cold time. Inside the old scrub is still damp. It's wet. It won't go into the scrub. You just sort of burn on the edge with the dry. That's how we save the scrub. Sorry, so there's a few different quotes, but they know exactly this plant got last rained on this long ago, and the grass is too crumbly, so we can't do a burn here now. We're going to have to wait.
And I think it's important to, you know, the variety as well of different, not just heats of burn, but size as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you're talking about cool burning, you can be talking about fires that might only be an inch or two off the ground.
That's right.
That burn so cool that you only get white smoke, which is, you know, that's a very specific kind of burn. We need to kind of, you know, complicate, I guess, our understanding of what you think of when you think fire.
Yeah.
Because we associate it with a certain thing here, like I think settlers do in Australia. We associate it with bushfire. We picture large flames and hot and destruction. And it's a different, you know, this is a very different kind of conceptual way of relating to fire.
And these cool flames also, they wouldn't be very tall, as you said, often only a couple of inches. And you could, there, you know, records from colonists saying that they could jump over them, or that one of them spent an entire day just following a fire, walking like 2 meters behind it at about walking pace as it burnt along. But it didn't catch the things that were around there. Like it didn't catch the trees, and people often talk about going through a burnt landscape, and like maybe one or two of the trees there might have gotten like caught and burnt out, but the vast majority of them have a little bit of ash and like some blackened like trunks, but they're just still completely there. And like this is a very me trying to use my like Western mindset to try and imagine what this is like, but I guess it's kind of like, you know, we could replicate it on a small scale, and I strongly suggest no one does this, but like watering the lawn and then putting a bit of tissue paper and setting fire to that, the tissue paper will burn up, maybe the grass under it might singe a little bit, but it's not going to spread. And I think that's kind of how we can sort of visual, that's how I'm visually imagining these cool fires.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for those details, Noon. Hopefully throughout this messy and tangential and piecemeal discussion, we have hopefully, if you are a settler, you know, conveyed a little bit more of the kind of complexity and nuance around the concept of cultural burning. I have a quote here that I thought might be a nice way to round out this discussion, which is another piece from Indigenous X from a writer named Jamie Graham Blair, who is a Trawlway Pakana man, and he's studying a Bachelor of Marine and Antarctic Science in Hobart at the moment, or Nipaluna, which is the First Nations name. So he writes, and this is kind of a lengthy quote, "Our diverse and complex cultures, including our languages, diets, technology, and kinship structures, at their core are dependent on the health of the environment that shaped them. My people, the Trawlway Pakana of northeastern Tasmania, have been proven to have not just survived on my homelands, but thrived for a bare minimum of 42,000 years. You don't belong to one of the world's oldest continuing cultures by not being sustainable and in touch with the needs of the land you occupy. This is why the invasion of our country, the destruction of our knowledge, and breakdown of our family systems at the hands of the invading Europeans was not just damaging to us as a sovereign people, but to the land itself. Whatever the course of action may be, it's obvious that for the sake of our planet, Indigenous voices need to be heard. Indigenous strength must be shared. The spirits and history of this land must be respected, and we must resource those who know how to manage it. We need to see true collaboration between science, culture, and politics, and we need to see it happen on a massive global scale. Australia is uniquely positioned to do this, being the home of the world's oldest continuing culture, but we must act, and quickly." So this is obviously an incredibly complicated and multifaceted discussion, but at the core of it, I think what we want people to take away is that land management is, and bushfire protection and climate action is sovereignty. That's what we need to do, and that's what our conversation should be focused around. You can't just pull out a single piece of First Nations culture or identity or knowledge and deploy that to protect the colony. That is not how this works.
This episode is going to be coming out on Invasion Day, and we thought it was useful to focus a little bit more on these sorts of issues, and hopefully it's probably too late to encourage you to go now, but if you're listening to this on Invasion Day, but hopefully you turned out to the rallies. Zach and I are both going to be there, and I think Invasion Day, you know, there's sort of an analogous situation with the whole change the date thing, where, you know, the organizers of the Invasion Day rallies have been super clear that it's not about changing the date, and that changing the date is just a way for colonists to turn the volume on this issue down, basically.
Mm, yeah. And we can still have our fun barbecue day, just at a different time.
One that's slightly less insensitive. But obviously, like, genocide has happened year-round and is
celebrating
still happening.
Celebrating, quote-unquote, Australia at any point of the year is always going to be
inappropriate and yeah. not okay. Yeah.
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 So, one of the things that you can do, aside from attend the rally is, the various rallies is to pay the rent and, or offer a donation to an Indigenous organization. So we specifically want to recommend donating to Fire Sticks, who, as we mentioned earlier, are, cultural burning practitioners and teachers.
Educators, yeah.
So, you can, go to our website, firesticks.org.au to donate.
And check out their podcast. It's really cool and easy to listen to. Another way you can pay the rent is at invasionday.org, and there's a link up the top, pay the rent and campaigns, and they have a few different places that you can donate to. Or you can look up where which nation you're living on the land of, and most of them have corporations or organizations that need support, financial and otherwise. Yeah, so that's you should definitely consider doing that.
Yeah. Cool. Next week, we'll be back to our regularly scheduled programming and probably making some more jokes, hopefully.
Yeah.
But until then, I think, now is a really important time for us settlers to reflect and work out what it means to live and work on stolen land and how we want to conduct ourselves, given that context.
Keep on snacking in the outpost of the British Empire.
Definitely.